All right, good afternoon. My name is Leif Johnson, and I'm here today as an intern at the Sioka Center for Business Ethics and Society, where I'm promoting the message that one can major in anything and succeed in business. We have a special guest today, Ted Lynch. He's a managing director at Bank of America's Corporate Banking Group in Boston. So if you could, Ted, we'd love to have you share a quick summary of your path to Holy Cross, and we'll dive into some questions right after that.
Okay, Leif, my path to Holy Cross is probably not very exciting. Back if you were a person going to one of the feeder schools that supplies Holy Cross and Boston College, that being Severian, my high school, the high schools around Boston, like Fordham Prep and Xavier, that sent kids to Holy Cross, same thing
right
here. So, you know, your choices when you're 16, 17 years old. We didn't have the Common App. You had to type out your applications on forms that you get from college. So you didn't go very broad in your design. So like a lot of people, I applied to Holy Cross, Notre Dame, and BC. My choice came down to Holy Cross. My dad had been a graduate in 1953. He'd actually been on the faculty. Okay. At BC, my grandfather was a BC guy, so it was BC Holy Cross. And back in those days, prior to the arrival of Doug Flutie, Holy Cross had some level of panache. BC was then a growing power. They're two great schools, but happy to have chosen Holy Cross. My best friends in life are still my best friends from Holy Cross.
Yeah, no, I totally hear that. But anyways, I mean, that's a great path. Like you, I had a, you know, a long, windy path to Holy Cross. I got to say, you know, I first met you my freshman year through the corporate finance and banking workshop offered by the Sioka Center. And, you know, you hosted a group of 20 students, and we've stayed in touch since, you know, given our shared interest in finance in the New York Jets. But on a more serious note, you know, I know the college's motto is men and women for others, but you know, why do you choose to give back to Holy Cross? Like, what do you get out of it?
I chose to give back to Holy Cross because it was an important part of my life. I probably spent a lot more time and a lot more energy giving back to Holy Cross because right after our 15th reunion, when I'd done some volunteering, helping people get back together and calling and asking for money, I bumped into the person who had my class chair at a golf course on Cape Cod and recommended that for next 20 to 20th reunion, we ought to do X, Y, Z, and Z. And he called me a couple of weeks later and said, hey, why don't you become a class chair? So
part of it was
them asking me, and I've been doing it now for 20 years. It's very enjoyable for me because it allows me to stay in touch with classmates. We really have a terrific class after all these years. We just had our 35th reunion, and 64% of my classmates made a gift to Holy Cross. And we've got an incredibly generous class. And what's also kind of interesting, when you get later in life, and I've got classmates who's have kids that have gone to other colleges. Some have gone to Holy Cross. Some have had kids declined application to Holy Cross.
Really?
It is, yes, and it happens. And the love of alma mater hasn't changed, even when you go through disappointments. We've had classmates that will call me in anger about some political or social or some other aspect of the college decision making, which has frustrated them. I'm never to give money again, but guess what? They come back and they give money every single year. With the fallout from the Crusader thing a couple of years ago, people swore they would never give again, but it all comes back. They still love it.
Yeah, that's awesome, Ted. I can definitely understand that. So, you know, like, while we're still on the topic of Holy Cross, you know, I got to hear a lot about, you know, your classmates and whatnot, and I'm sure a lot were economics majors, just like yourself. So being that I'm an economics major as well, like, I'm curious, you know, how has your liberal arts education impacted your career, you know, from the beginning and, you know, now and today?
this might sound kind of cliche, but I would say that what Holy Cross will teach you to do is to think critically and persuasively. I think that's the liberal arts aspect of things. And right. What I mean by that is that I'll use an example in banking. You know, we're always competing for business, and our clients probably want the most flexibility, the cheapest pricing, the best structure, the most money. You know, they want to push the envelope on what they can possibly do in getting a financing done. The best banker will be the one who convinces their clients to do things the way our bank management wants things done.
Ah, I see.
As opposed to convincing our bank management to do things the way the clients want things done. So there's an ability that I think most Holy Cross people have to think critically and translate that into a way that allows them to be persuasive, okay? Now, it's also very important that it's not just economics that you get that sort of grounding at Holy Cross. I know plenty of people who are in banking, they were classics majors, even Latin majors or history majors. The same elements apply where you can sit down, assess a situation, comprise a strategy, and convince it to do it in the best way that your firm would like to have it done.
Yeah, no, and I agree with that, Ted. I mean, I can see myself in the same shoes that you were. And like you were saying, like, it's not just economics. It's, you know, you're constantly challenging yourself with every rotation or in every semester that you endure. Like, you're going from economics classes to religion classes to, you know, even I'm taking a dance class right now. So it's really always challenging.
Good for you. You going to take up rugby?
I don't know about rugby, but
they'll fill out a blind spot for you. You ought to do that.
Yeah, no,
I'm interrupting you. Go ahead, Lee.
No worries. I played football back in the day, but I don't know if those cleats are going to come back on anytime soon. But yeah, I think, like, you're exactly right. Like I was saying, it's definitely, you know, a challenge to take some of those classes at times. And some of my classmates always, you know, question, like, why are we taking these classes? But at the end of the day, it'll probably come full circle, and you'll realize when you're in a position like yourself that it was, you know, beneficial going to all those classes, regardless of what the subject matter was. So anyways, yeah, I think that was a great answer, Ted. And, you know, now I heard some of your passions for Holy Cross and, you know, the impact the liberal arts education has had on you. But now I'm curious to hear more about your career at Bank of America. And, you know, you've been there for 15 years now. So that leads me to ask you, what keeps you coming back each and every day?
I got to pay bills, for starters. I've actually been 15 years with Bank of America, but 27 years in this same building. I'm in my 28th year in this building. Right.
Wow.
So Bank of America bought the predecessor banks that I started with. So I've literally been working at the same location for now in my 28th year.
I don't think many people can say that.
Yeah. Well, it is kind of unusual. We've gone through in banking, we've had lots of changes, lots of consolidation. When you have cycles, you have layoffs and job reductions and things like that. So I'm probably fortunate, a little bit of luck, a little bit of hard work gets you through down cycles. What gets me coming into work every single day is that I have a great group of colleagues that I work with. It's very funny for me. I just turned 57 to go through and work with people who are not just your age, just a little bit older, but people sort of in the generation in between.
Yeah,
and there's a lot of lingo and social and media references that I can throw out in a group of 10 people and nobody will pick up. So the television shows we were watching as kids in the 1960s were reruns in the 70s and even at the 80s. It is kind of funny that you'll say a line for a movie and have nobody know what the heck you're talking about. So that part is fun. It's great having younger people be rejuvenated. And I also think back to, you know, my first bosses in this business who were all terrific people, who also got to the point in their lives in the late 50s, their late 50s, where they start, you know, appreciating, you know, what we've got to do to hand off responsibility, knowledge, judgment to younger people. That's a lot of fun. That keeps me in, keeps me coming in. The other thing to do is it's a business that even in tough times, if you've got a great group of clients that you work with, you know, sometimes when they're having great difficulty, you provide is more value to a company that's feeling like they're in trouble as you provide sometimes when they're feeling like they're on the tail end of a hockey stick and everything's going great. They'll enjoy the upside. Sometimes one of the best parts of the job is providing assurance and confidence for companies who are feeling challenged and clients who are feeling challenged. They kind of go hand in hand.
Yeah, no, I think that's great, Ted. And I really love your reference to the, you know, the 60s cartoons, because my father's also 57 years old. So I definitely hear a handful of those. But yeah, on the other hand, great to hear that, you know, you have a multitude of reasons of why you really are passionate for, you know, what you do. And, you know, now I would love to ask you, you know, being that you're talking how much you love working at Bank of America, like, what do you love most about, like, investment banking specifically and the restaurant industry, since you're heavily involved in that?
I think that what is interesting, especially in the last few years, is it's going through a dramatic period of change. And the change is not being driven by appetites. You know, a few years ago, they might have been talking about Atkins diets and cholesterol and low carbs and things like that. I think people now say, we'll eat what we feel like eating. What's really, really dramatic, and it's very hard to think about, is if you're running a restaurant business, the way you get paid today for selling a meal, they have burger, fries, and Coke. The way you get paid today can come in about 12 or 13 different forms. 15 years ago,
yeah, no, you're right.
You're getting paid cash, maybe a credit card, maybe a debit card. 25 years ago, you were just going to get paid cash for a burger, Coke, and a fry. Okay.
Yes.
Now what you have is people can order online. People can order through the app designed by the restaurant brand, whether it's McDonald's, just like Chipotle. Or Chipotle, Panera. They've got their own apps. You can drive. You can drive up and hold out your phone and pay with you know, holding your thumb on the doohickey on your iPhone or your whatever your smartphone is. No contact, okay? Still payment like that. And then you've got Uber Eats, Grubhub, DoorDash, etc. All use some variation of debit or credit or some cashless transactions that will come in. If you have any accounting classes, you can think that it's easy to record those transactions in your sales and your accounting ledgers. But if you have 12 or 13 different ways that money is being transacted, some are having fees withheld, some are having a flat charge for delivery. It is a robust challenge for companies to keep up with how the technology has changed to make sure they're not missing a single transaction. They've got to be able to receive payments all those different ways and be able to transact business as soon as the initiative hits you to go buy that burger, fries, and Coke. And it's happening very, very fast.
Yeah.
We're going through a period of great change. There's going to be winners and losers that come out of it.
Yeah, and for sure, I completely agree. Definitely some uncharted territory we see. But yeah, I think Ted, like that was great. I I'm really interested, as you know, in the restaurant industry, being that in the student investment fund, I'm in the consumer group. So, you know, what's a company that you really have, you know, found a keen interest in as of late? Like, what's really, you know, sparking your eye?
I think that all of the big restaurant chains have different elements that are intriguing to them. One is the technological aspect. As I talked about, it's affecting all of them.
Right.
You're going to have situations where states are raising their minimum wages. So the impact on a restaurant operator's profitability can be squeezed because of their labor costs going up. Labor is usually about 30 to 35% of a company's operating costs, or their, actually of their sales, and a big chunk of their operating costs. So if that cost goes up substantially, which it is in a lot of states, you know, how do you manage that? You manage that in some cases through technology. If you go into all the big restaurant chains, the quick service restaurant chains, you're going to start seeing more ordering kiosks. The cost of those kiosks will offset the cost of higher labor. So, you know, that whole technological opportunity that exists is still there. It's still driving a lot of the activity that is going on in the marketplace. And that's one aspect of it. But you have to be willing to spend the money
yes.
to get those technological improvements.
Yes. Yes.
And if you're not confident that the return on investment is going to be there, people are going to be hesitant. So what you see going on in a lot of the large restaurant brands at the same time is there's a need to continually update and improve your restaurants, how they appear, how they generate somebody's desire to say, let's go to that McDonald's.
Right.
People have that idea, let's go to McDonald's or let's go to Dunkin' or let's go to Wendy's. Their decision to go in there on an impulse decision is always going to be enhanced when you have a big, bright, shiny, newer looking building than an older, tired, underinvested restaurant. And so when you look at all the need to keep your restaurant fresh and relevant and technologically to scale, it does involve a lot of reinvestment. It sometimes involves a lot of borrowing, and sometimes people don't feel there's a comfort zone that they can make all those investments. So what's also happening in those big chains is that you have an aging population of operators, restaurant owners, franchisees. And, you know, a lot of the people who got into this business in the 1970s and 1980s are in their 70s and 80s.
Yep. No, I
stop. So, you know, having to make decisions on whether to retire, whether there's consolidation, whether there are enough people willing to consolidate more restaurant ownership, all these things have the industry in a little bit of a state of flux. We go through these cycles from time to time. We're kind of in that cycle of people saying, okay, who's going to bear up and be the next generation of people operating restaurants around the country?
Yeah.
The number of meal opportunities that are out there, we have a country that still grows 1% to 2% per year. So the demand for restaurants keeps going up. But, you know, there's restaurants that are taking market share away from others. You have the Darwinian effect. There's going to be winners and losers that come out of this process. You'll have restaurants closed, but restaurants open.
Yeah, no, and I hear that. And I think that where that's going is definitely, you know, more towards the fast casual, like we've talked about, you know, in the past, that a lot of these people, like at least today, are extremely busy in their everyday lives. And, you know, they need a quality meal at a quality price in, you know, a short period of time. But yeah, no, Ted, I think that was really interesting. Thanks for taking the time to explain that. And I think that's all we have for today, though. So, you know, just to wrap up, you know, all those who are listening, just know that, you know, the Sioka Center programs that have given many students access to the Holy Cross Alumni Network, just to people like you, Ted. It's an impressive network that has many people, and it's always willing to help students. And people should know that it's never too early to start making these connections. So, again,
I will add to that, I wish we had something like the Sioka Center when we were in college.
Exactly, yeah. really thankful for it.
It's a great thing you guys got. It's great that you're alumni that continue to support. You guys are doing a great job. We are all alumni are proud of you guys. We really are. You're doing a great job. So
thank you, Ted.
Good work.
Yeah, and thanks for your time again today.
All right. Thanks.